Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show that introduces you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. For me and cartoon lovers, author and cartoonist Jeff Smith needs no introduction. His popular graphic novel series Bone, nationally and internationally recognized with over 50 issues. Also, Razzle and Tukey, Save the Humans, are just some of his works. And he's one of our own. He spent 4 years writing cartoons for the Lantern newspaper at Ohio State University and has spent a lot of time living in Columbus. Welcome to All Sides, Jeff.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
So there's so much to talk about, but let's start with, is there anything new you want to share? I know you're working on a new Tukey book. Is that the newest thing you have going on?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I did Bone for like 12 years, but I had a finalized story. I knew what the ending was before I started. And I hit that at about 12 years. Then I did Razzle, which is more like science fiction and noir. And now I'm working on Tukey, which is a story about human evolution. It takes place 2 million years ago. And the thing that kicked it off for me was that when I read something about the moment our earliest ancestor, Homo erectus, figured out how to control fire, make it happen, and eat cooked food. And at that moment, the other earlier versions of humans were still around. I know you look at the bumper sticker that shows a chimpanzee slowly standing up, but they don't go away. Just some of them turn into us, right? So I thought that was interesting. You could have a story around the moment when our earliest ancestors started making fires and eating cooked food, but all the earlier versions of us were still around at that time, 2 billion years ago. Australopithecus, Homo habilis, the two earliest tool makers. And I just, in my head, I got very excited about this idea that what if all the other humans, why did they not get involved? Why didn't they start making fire and eating cooked food? Instead, they thought that our ancestors that led to us were doing something that was taboo and was against nature. And so that's the story I started writing. It's going to be a 6-novel graphic novel series, and two of them are out now. But what I'm really working on now, besides the newest Tukey novel, which is the one I'm talking about, is I'm doing Kickstarters. We're doing deluxe versions, and we're taking my most popular work, which is Bone, and we're doing these large versions of it in black and white with all sorts of behind the scenes, almost like they were DVDs or Blu-rays or something, with back matter and stuff. That's what we're working on now.
Wow. So is that something people can buy? You're doing a Kickstarter to make them, or?
What we do, we're doing a Kickstarter to kick them off. And they've been massive. They've been very successful. I didn't really understand Kickstarter when we started. I thought Kickstarter was not something you did if you were already professional, but I have friends in the business who said, you've got to do this. And they were right. It's grand. So anyway, it's a way to kick off a project.
Let people know about it. Yeah. Raise awareness.
Then we get it. And then we put it into the distribution system, into bookstores and comic bookstores and stuff.
Okay. I understand. I was reading an interview you did with The Lantern. And in the interview, you told a story about your art teacher telling you back in the day that you'll never make it to Disney. Can you tell us? Can you tell us that story?
Yeah. I was a senior in high school, in 1978. And, I didn't have too many teachers that I melded with, but this one art teacher, I loved him, and he seemed to like me too. We got along, and he pulled me into his office one time, and he said, what are your plans? What are you doing? Where are you going? And I said something about, well, I don't know. I'm, I, I, I'm interested in animation. I might go to Disney. And he says, forget it. You would last a day at Disney. And I was devastated. I thought he was, and I thought, I'm only a kid, but I could draw pretty good. They could teach me, couldn't they? And he wasn't saying I wasn't good enough. He was just saying, you're just too much of an asshole. you don't get along with anybody. You don't follow the rules. You need to go out on your own and figure out what you're going to do.
You got to be below PG-13 to work at Disney, I guess.
I don't know. I hope I didn't swear too much right there for you.
That's okay. That's okay.
I'll watch it. I'll watch it.
You had a popular comic strip in The Lantern. I mean, how popular was that? Whenever you think back to your college days and you think about doing a comic for The Lantern, what's your best memory from that?
Oh my goodness. I had seen when I went to OSU, I had seen The Lantern, and occasionally they would put in a student comic strip. There was nothing like 5 days a week at all. And I thought, well, that's what I want to do. I want to be a comic strip artist. And I went and talked to the student editors and showed them, you know, my comics. It was called Thorn at the time, but it was basically a dry run at my bone characters. Mm-hmm. And they said, yeah, this is all right. And I said, well, you know, newspapers should have a daily comic strip. That's what newspapers do. And they kind of agreed with that. And they said, well, tell you what, we're going to show it around to the other editors and we'll call you in a couple of days. And they did. And they said, you're in. Hmm. So that was the first big moment where I was like, wow. And then I think it's September 20th of that year, I think it was 82, the paper came out and there were my characters in print. For the first time, I was 22 years old. I was so excited. That was a huge moment. And then on the wall of The Lantern, did you go to OSU? Were you ever part of The Lantern or anything?
I did grad school at OSU, but not undergrad. So no, I wasn't part of The Lantern. Yeah.
Okay. Well, but there was a huge wall of like cubby holes, and everybody that worked there, every student had a cubby. Mm-hmm. So there'd be mail in there. And I had mail in there almost every day from people liking the strip. Mm. So I had a very good, I got good feedback from them. I always got along with the editors. Sometimes I even drew the editors into the comic because I was just trying to figure out what comics can do. And it was fun. Sometimes I got in trouble. Sometimes I It was exciting.
I would expect nothing less, yes. This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with cartoonist Jeff Smith, who is from Columbus and went to Ohio State. So I was reading that you were born in McKees Rocks, Pennsylvania, but most of your life you spent in Columbus. Do you consider Columbus home?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was born near Pittsburgh, where McKees Rocks is. But my folks moved to Columbus when I was like 1.5 or 2 years old. Mm. So I grew up in Columbus. I went to the Colonial Hills Elementary School in I guess that's in Worthington.
Yeah.
And then Worthington High School. So I went to Ohio State, and I only bought a house in Key West like 10 years ago. So I still have a home in German Village. My wife and I spend all summer and fall. We love Ohio in the fall.
Tell me about your creative process. How does a graphic novel come about? You kind of told me how you discovered how you were going to do Tukey, but in general, what's your creative process whenever you're trying to like come up with something?
Well, most of the time, it's like I'm getting towards the end of a project. And I'm inking. And when I'm inking, I've already drawn it and written it, which is the hard part. But inking takes skill, but I can think. I can listen to music. I can watch DVDs with director commentary. And as I'm getting toward the end of Bone, I was watching tons of film noir and listening to director commentaries or other commentaries. And I started to really get into that. So in this case, it led me to what became RASL, which is an acronym for Romance at the Speed of Light. And RASL was this character who somehow ended up with Tesla's Nikola Tesla, the rival of Edison, who, when he died, all his papers were taken out of his apartment by the government.
Mm-hmm.
And the big conspiracy theory around that is that they were all hidden in the original Area 51, which is Wright-Patt Air Force Base. That was the original Area 51. So I came up with this idea that in the 40s, when Tesla was at his height, he was going to, during the World War II, he wanted to have a meeting at the White House because, you know, the Nazis were attacking his home country, which I think it was Yugoslavia. But that's, I'm not quite mm-hmm. remembering that right. But anyway, somewhere over there near Germany. Anyway, he had a meeting set up with the president to present some super weapon he had envisioned. And then the night before his meeting, he died in his apartment in New York City. So all our conspiracy theories in America, I have learned since, all zero in. UFOs, everything. Everything zeroes back to Nikola Tesla. So anyway, I had a lot of fun. That, I think, is the best way I can describe how I can come up with ideas to do a book.
Become fascinated by something and get hooked on it. Yeah. Yeah.
And think of the silly story that I can make out of it, the comic book story I can make out of that.
My producer, Aaron, Google champion, Tesla's home country was Croatia. So there you go.
Thank you.
So do you still draw everything by hand, or have you started using computers for some of it?
No, everything's by hand. Hmm. I draw on paper, 2-ply bristle board, and I use a brush and dip it into an ink bottle and do everything by hand. Just like it's very old school. And I have a lot of young assistants or people who come to work with me and help me and stuff. And they all try to get me to try it on the computer. Just try it. I'm like, no, it's too late for me, man. I have fun and I'm really good at it. I'm not going to learn some new thing.
Yeah, that, I guess that's what I was going to ask you. If I mean, eventually you got to scan everything in, so it gets into a computer somehow. But do you want to stay at by hand for forever? That's your plan?
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. I don't have much more forever to go, I don't think, at this point. But I can't do it. People will say, "We could do a sequel to Bone." It's like, oh my God, I can't do a 1,300 page book. I'm not going to live that long. But I am having fun. I'm kidding. I mean, I'm having fun. I like to draw. I still draw the Bone characters, but I do a little short stories. I made them up when I was like a kid, and I've drawn them my whole life, and I still like to draw them. So I come up with reasons to draw them.
So you can't, you don't let go of Bone. Bone's still a part of your, at least a few times a month you're drawing that.
Yeah, for sure.
Tell me about some of the challenges that came with self-publishing, because that's one thing that you're known for with the self-publishing to start off.
It was, at first I wanted, as I mentioned a little earlier, I wanted to be a newspaper comic strip artist. I was such a fan of Peanuts and Pogo by Walt Kelly and Doonesbury when I was in high school by Trudeau. I wanted to be a newspaper comic strip artist. But I did a daily strip in the Lantern, as you mentioned, for 4 years. And when I got done, I immediately started sending them out to the newspaper syndicates, which are these, like, they're like agencies that newspapers won't buy a comic strip from a individual person. They buy them through these agencies. So I was sending my strips to these newspaper syndicates, and they clearly liked my humor and my artwork, but they didn't like the fantasy element of Thorn, which was really what Bone became when I went into comic books. And I spent like years drawing 2 weeks worth of comic strips for these guys, these editors who would make these inane suggestions that just dumbed down the strip to the point where I couldn't take it anymore. I knew what they were asking me to do. They were asking me to make it like Garfield.
Mm.
But I'm not a Garfield guy.
You don't strike me as
Garfield.
I'm
not knocking Garfield. When Garfield came out in the early 80s, I read that every day and laughed my butt off. But man, That's not the kind of comics I do. I go back to the old Flash Gordon, Dick Tracy, Tarzan kind of stuff. But they were not going for that. So what happened is I had one final meeting with, I won't knock any particular editor or anything, I won't say their names, but I had the meeting in New York and I showed him my latest round and he said, "I have a great idea. Why don't you make everybody talk in thought balloons?" Thought balloons, you know, where they're bubbles and it's what they're thinking. I go, "Well, how does that work? What are you talking about?" He goes, "Well, Garfield talks in thought balloons." Yeah, Garfield thinks to himself.
He's a
He doesn't
cat.
talk to anybody in thought balloons. This was like the most important editor of comics in the business, and he didn't have any idea how comic strips even worked. And I just left the meeting. I never took any. When these comic strip syndicates editors would call me, I wouldn't take the phone calls anymore. I was done. I was like, I'm broken, which leads me to about 5 years later, I saw an article in the Columbus Dispatch. It was like a two pages in full color on like in the magazine section about a Batman comic book that was blowing people's minds, and they had pictures. I was like, this is not the Batman, the little color form Batman that I remember as a kid in the 60s. It was very dynamic. It was done by a guy named Frank Miller, and it was called The Dark Knight Returns. And it was one of the first graphic novels. And it was very exciting. I went into a comic book store, picked it up, and I said, "This is where I've got to go. This is a medium where you can tell a story and not have editors try to make your characters talk in thought balloons." And that's what got me on the self-publishing tour. Not that I wanted to, because it's a heck of a lot of work. It's a lot of work. But I did it. I was able to do what I wanted, and it all worked.
And it worked out very well. We've been talking with Jeff Smith, cartoonist and creator of Bone, among many other notable works. Jeff, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been great. It was really fun to talk to you, Amy, because I've been listening to you since you first popped on.
Oh, wow. Oh, really? Thanks.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so much for joining us. And
My pleasure.
coming up, we are talking with the founder of Columbus Food Adventures. That's when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show from WOSU and All Sides that introduces you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Columbus's food scene is robust. There are more restaurants than bus stops in this city. Columbus Food Adventures gets you a little closer to experiencing Columbus's food variety efficiently. The food tour was rated twice among the top 10 best food tours in America by USA Today. In 2024, they were voted number one, and this April, they were voted number seven. Co-founder of Columbus Food Adventures, Bethia Wolf, is with us today. Welcome to All Sides, Bethia.
Thank you.
So, have you always been a foodie?
Yes. Yeah, I have always enjoyed eating, and I love to travel, and food is such an intrinsic part of traveling, I think.
So what inspired you to start Columbus Food Adventures in the first place?
Well, I'll try and give you a succinct version.
Yeah.
We were running a website called Taco Trucks Columbus. That was kind of how the first thing we did. I had started just kind of a food blog that was called Hungry Wolf, and then we started Taco Trucks Columbus, and that got a lot of interest. We were in the Dispatch, and we were on TV. We thought it was very exciting. Mm-hmm. And then that led us into starting a website called Old Eats Columbus, because as we were exploring all these kind of areas of the city with all these taco trucks, we started discovering all the Somali restaurants, mm-hmm. and all of these other international cuisines in Columbus. So Old Eats, the idea was to cover smaller immigrant restaurants. Mm-hmm. And then people started asking if they could come with us and do things, you know. So that was kind of one strand of what led to the food tours. The other strand was that one of my friends was living in New York City at the time, mm-hmm. and he went on a food tour there with his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you should do this. This would be perfect for you. And I was like, well, I don't want to move to New York. And so then it kind of these things started coming together, and we realized this was something we could do in Columbus.
Wow. Were you always the friend, like the designated friend, whenever you're going to go out to dinner, you pick the food spot?
Yeah, I'm also guilty of also trying to pick what everyone's going to order as well.
You're going to get that. You're going to get that. We're going to, yeah, a little bit of everything. All right. So Columbus Food Adventures has been named on the USA Today's 10 Best Food Tours list twice. So in 2025, you're in seventh place. And last year in 2024, you were number one. How does it feel to have Columbus and your organization recognized on a national stage?
It was really exciting. I think it was particularly exciting for us because in all of the local, you know, the best of Columbus, all these surveys come out every year, and there isn't a food tour category. So, you know, it's always best coffee shop, best Mexican, you know. So we had never been voted, you know, for anything. We'd never had anything like that. So to then have something national. And I think it speaks to, we have such an amazing group of partner restaurants and food businesses that we work with. And I think it's a real credit to them. And our team, we have amazing guides that work with us, the people that are really passionate about the city. But we also have really, really great customers. And they, I think, were really voting every day, encouraging other people to vote. And I think it's, you know, our business, Columbus is a different city from other cities that have food tours. You know, we're not as touristy a destination as maybe, you know, New York City or Key West, places like that. And so our food tours, we get a lot more locals on mm-hmm. our food tours. And so I think because of that, we've kind of built this community. We have a lot of regular customers. Mm-hmm. And so I think they were really wanting us to do well in the voting.
When was Columbus Food Tours born? Like when?
So actually, we just celebrated our 15th anniversary this summer.
Oh, congratulations. 15 years.
Yeah.
So tell me, how has Columbus as a foodie town changed in those 15 years?
I mean, it's constantly changing. You know, it's keeping up with everything that's new, everything that's opening is a lot. I think the city, the food scene has definitely become a lot more international mm-hmm. Than it used to be. We did a survey earlier this year. We found cuisines represented from 70 different countries. Mm. And so I think that's definitely one of the big changes. I think, you know, we see new trends come and go at the mm-hmm. moment. It's the Yemeni coffee shops. They're just kind of popping up everywhere. And, you know, over the last 15 years, obviously fast casual has mm-hmm. increased a lot. Now it's kind of the more delivery and that side of thing, the food halls. Mm-hmm. So it's always evolving. It's always something new.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about Columbus Food Adventures with the company's founder, Bethia Wolf, the company's co-founder, Bethia Wolf. The Midwest, especially Ohio, rarely is the center of attention. So was it challenging to convince people that Columbus could be a serious food destination? Or I guess it's more so you're saying people from here want to eat the food here.
Yeah, I think Columbus, I mean, we certainly get out-of-towners. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We certainly get people who are visiting Columbus. But I think the thing that sets us apart is that we get the locals as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Columbus, I mean, every city, people kind of get in their bubble, they're in their neighborhood. And so you don't always venture out to different parts of the city you don't know as well, unless somebody's giving you a reason to do that. But, you know, Try and get back to your question. I don't think it was hard. I mean, I think...
I guess putting Columbus on the map as a foodie city, someone from New York would be like, really? Columbus, Ohio? But you're like, yes, absolutely.
We are. You know, one of the fun things that right since the beginning, we've always done a taco truck tour. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we sometimes get skepticism from people that kind of like, you know, tacos and, you know, in Columbus. And then but we have people that come on our tour who have lived in California or Texas, and they're really impressed by the food that they have on that tour. So it's kind of fun to be able to exceed people's expectations and surprise them and give them experiences they didn't think they were going to have in Ohio.
Now, you offer a lot of tours. They're all very different. But are most of them walking? And some of them are bus. I don't know how it divides up.
Yeah, most of them are walking. We found that the neighborhood walking tours are really popular. Mm-hmm. So we focus them in the historic areas that have great dining. So the German Village, Old Worthington, Short North, Dublin, those kind of neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. But then also, as you can probably tell, we're really passionate about all of the different international cuisines and the immigrant restaurants in Columbus. And so those often are not tours that would be practical walking. And mm-hmm. so when we do those are the van based. And then we also, one of our new tours is a food hall tour. Mm-hmm. And so that one, also, obviously you can't walk between all of the food halls. So mm-hmm. that one's a van one as well.
And whenever if someone hasn't been on one of your tours before, you write that you'll eat enough food on the tour to replace a meal, mm-hmm. right? So, but you're getting to taste at a bunch of different places. So you contact the restaurant ahead of time and tell them you have 12 people coming and they make 12 little samples. Is that how it works?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we, as I said, we have a really great network of restaurants mm-hmm. that we work with, and they, really want to give the guests a great experience. Obviously, the restaurant's hoping that people will come back and eat there again, and they want to show off their culture, their food, their neighborhood. So, it's usually at least 5, sometimes up to 8 different restaurants that you'll visit on one tour. Mm.
Do you have any anecdotes from a local restaurant that really helped put you on the map? Is there... I'm not trying to make you pick a favorite, right? Because that's not fair. But and just any anecdote of like a food tour where the restaurant is just like a popular destination.
Oh, I mean, honestly, there's just too many to mention. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we're very lucky that we've had a lot of partners that have been with us since we started our business. We are really privileged to be able to take people to restaurants like Barcelona and German Village and for them to kind of experience and see their wonderful patio and try some of their signature dishes. But we have, you know, great restaurants like Brazilian Grill and Bakery that's up on the north side that's mm-hmm. on our Alt Eats tour. And they are just such wonderful hosts and really just want to make people have a great experience when they're often trying Brazilian food for the first time.
The walking tours, I'm guessing, are more popular in the summer, but do you offer them all year round?
Some of them are year round. Mm-hmm. Some of them are more seasonal. So it mm-hmm. depends on the neighborhood and how much walking is involved, whether or not it's practical to run it through the winter.
And do you run most of the tours, or do you have people?
We do. We have my husband and myself. My husband is the other founder. He primarily runs our Old Pete's tour, which is mm-hmm. the international tour. He also runs the taco truck tour. And then we have a team of about 20 guides. Mm-hmm. It's a really fun kind of eclectic group. We have lawyers, teachers, pastors, students, doctor. We have a doctor. We have all kinds of mm-hmm. People. Realtors, and they just share. They're really passionate about Columbus, the Columbus food scene. They love meeting people. So they're generally all people that have a full-time job, and it's just something they do for fun at the weekend.
The qualification is must love food.
It's one of the qualifications, yeah.
Must love food, must love Columbus.
Yeah, you'd be able to talk loudly enough for a group and be on time, be punctual.
Do you change your tours when new restaurants open, or do you wait for a restaurant to establish itself? I mean, if something new and trendy pops up, do you try to incorporate a tour right away?
Yeah, I would say more usually for the tours, we let people get established. Mm-hmm. So we also, you know, in addition to the tours, over the years, we've become, I would say, kind of a food experience company as well. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of dinners as well. And we do different corporate events and kind of other things, anything related to food in Columbus, and so with the dinners, sometimes we'll use a newer restaurant. But for the tours, usually it's letting them get more established.
Mm. Do you have restaurants seek, like, call you and say, hey, add me?
We do, yeah, mm-hmm. sometimes. Unfortunately, often they're not necessarily in the right neighborhood. But we do. We definitely have restaurants reaching out to us.
Have you ever had to, like, has a restaurant ever closed and it was a part of your tour and you were sad and you had to pivot? Has that happened?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the restaurant industry is a really hard business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the statistics of how many restaurants make it, you know, a year, 3 years, 5 years is it's sad, honestly. It's it's very challenging. So, yeah, we've definitely had restaurants that have closed. But luckily, the Columbus food scene is deep enough. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we have to, you know, be a little creative or rework our route. But we always manage to find other restaurants that we can work with.
You said you've been around for 15 years. So that means that you survived the pandemic.
Yep.
What was your pivot during that time?
So this one is definitely credit to my husband. He came up with the idea of doing something that we called Trustful. Mm-hmm. And Trustful was basically particularly trying to help out some of the smaller restaurants that mm-hmm. just weren't as geared up with their own social media and ability to pivot themselves. So we started doing dinner deliveries. Mm. And so people would sign up to have dinner delivered. And the trustful part was that they didn't know where it was going to come from. Ooh. So it could be Filipino, it could be Chinese, it could be Indian. And so then we would deliver them dinner for two. And it worked because there was no traffic, so you could make the deliveries quite easily. I actually had a customer tell me recently that she said, I think it saved our marriage during the pandemic, just having something different, a surprise.
Some interesting to eat, yeah. Wow.
And, but yeah, that was all Andy's idea. I can't really take credit for it, but we were able to help support a lot of different restaurants. We were able to give people some kind of interesting dining that... And it kind of kept us busy. We also started doing gift boxes with mm-hmm. local products. And actually, we still do those. Mm-hmm. The Trustful isn't pop.
I was going to ask if you still do it because yeah. It sounds fun. I mean, hard to coordinate logistically, but it sounds super
yeah.
fun.
Yeah, so Trustful is not possible anymore just because Columbus traffic has come back. Mm. But we kind of evolved that into doing some of the dinners. So every month we do what we call a taste of dinner, which is featuring a different international cuisine. So we've done recently Bolivian, Ethiopian, Sri Lankan. We just did a Sri Lankan dinner.
Is that at one location then, or is it?
It's usually at the restaurant.
Okay.
Yeah. So typically it's at a restaurant, and then we get them to kind of dive deep into their cuisine with different regional dishes or things mm-hmm. that aren't on the menu. We try and feature cuisines that people might not have experienced as much.
Hence the adventure.
Yeah. And then the gift boxes is something we just do at the holidays, but we try and feature some of like our favorite vendors from the farmers markets, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed you have some tours, because you mentioned you have some tours that are outside of like Columbus proper. You have a Worthington one and a Dublin mm-hmm. one, is that
yeah.
right? Do you plan on adding any more cities? Or suburbs? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, we're always bouncing around ideas. I think at the moment, we'd like to... Our Old Eats tour, which is our international tour, is very mm-hmm. popular. And we have a lot of people who've come on that and really enjoyed it. So I think we'd like to add a kind of another version of that tour for people who've done that but want to explore some different cuisines. But
an Alt Eats?
Yeah.
Yeah. I knew. Okay. And then how do you accommodate... I feel like dietary restrictions have gotten more intense, especially if you've been around for 15 years, there are more dietary restrictions. How do you accommodate that? Or do people have to sign up for a tour that'll work for them?
So we accommodate vegetarians on almost all of mm-hmm. the tours. Because of the number of restaurants we go to, some of the other dietary restrictions are more complicated. Mm-hmm. because we're sort of the middleman between the restaurants and the customer, we can't always make guarantees about all of the ingredients used or if there's a risk of contamination for allergies. So sometimes, you know, we may say, you know, just like bungee jumping may not be the right activity for someone that's scared of heights, that a food tour may not be the right option for somebody that has a lot of dietary restrictions.
And just finally, where do you see your company in another 15 years?
Well, I hope that we will still be offering really fun, interesting food experiences in Central Ohio. We recently, last year, we just celebrated the first anniversary of Columbus Food Letter, which is a twice-a-week newsletter we do about food. So I'm hoping that that will continue to grow. Mm-hmm. That's something that gives us another outlet to share about new discoveries, things that are popping up that we think are interesting in Columbus food scene. So that's something I definitely hope will be thriving in 15 years' time.
Well, we've been talking about Columbus Food Adventures with the company's co-founder, Bethia Wolf. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And coming up on Fascinating Ohio, we're going to hear from an author who has a list of things your kid needs to do before you get them a cell phone. That is when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and Methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. One of the biggest flashpoints in parenting society today is screen time. And as our kids get older, that screen time debate turns into a device debate. When do you get your kid a phone? Anyone with a child above the age of 9 or 10 is struggling with this question. And whether you have kids or not, chances are you have an opinion about it, because everybody has an opinion about kids and phones. Our next guest says we have unintentionally deprived our younger generation of experiences that we grew up with. And that's what author Adam Ferguson is conveying in his recent book, The Things You Have to Do Before I Buy You a Phone. The book includes a list of 50 tasks that a child should do before they are given a phone. Adam Ferguson joins us today. Thanks for joining us.
Amy, thank you.
So the book has a list of things that a child should do before they're given a phone. Is the book's audience, is it intended for parents or for children to read, or both?
It's really for the kids. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a guidebook for coming of age, if mm-hmm. you will. But the, you know, I expect it's going to interest parents more than kids.
The title, at least. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and just because it's a list of things between the kid and a phone.
Yeah, yeah. So we can go through several things on the list throughout this conversation. But basically, you're running through some life skills. For example, number one is do laundry. Why does a kid need to do laundry before they can have a phone?
Well, I think, you know, the impetus for the book and the list was really... It was walking into some of my daughter's social events and seeing 10 little girls all heads down, kind of staring at screens, and thinking about my own childhood and the differences between these experiences, and thinking about the pendulum, how it had shifted from kind of the physical world to the digital world, and how much the void that a lot of these kids spend hours a day in. And then I was thinking about the experiences that they're not getting as a result. So, I mean, yeah, some of them are basic life skills, like learning how to do the laundry, learning how to, you know, cook dinner for the family. Some of them are more advanced life skills, like learning to build a fire, you know, learning how to run a 5K or swim 100 meters. And then some of them are a little more spiritual, like, you know, going on a weekend road trip with one of your parents or visiting a cemetery. But these are all experiences that have the kid kind of engage with just the physical world. And that's how we learned when we were growing up. And I worry that just the trial and error is not, the kids aren't getting it as much these days.
Yeah. The example you gave, I think I read it on your LinkedIn page, maybe, where you said that you walked into your daughter's sleepover, and instead of them all chit-chatting and the way and like or watching a movie, they were all looking at their phones.
Yeah, right? there were tablets, there were Nintendo Switches, there were one or two phones because it was her fifth grade sleepover.
Yeah, everyone had a different device. Yes,
right, and it was quiet.
Yeah,
you know, and that's kind of what got me to walk downstairs, just the quiet in the house.
Too quiet.
It's a parent trigger. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I walked down and saw that, I was like, man, you know, just what happened to childhood? I miss going out into the world and getting scuffed up. And
because I remember, like, for my sleepovers, playing Truth or Dare, you know, playing Light as a Feather, Stiff as a Board, all that stuff. So that wasn't happening.
Right. Well, yeah. Confronting boredom.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a big imagination trigger for kids. Mm. And so a lot of these experiences are meant to kind of provoke some of that.
One that I found interesting on your list was number 39, break a minor law.
Oh, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah, you want kids to be rule breakers?
Yeah, I think that's how progress gets done, you know, by looking at systems and questioning authority. You know, I'm pretty explicit about what not to do in that situation. But, you know, rules that your parents have made that you think are maybe unjust, one or two. Your school, you know, like, what are you questioning? Why are you questioning it? And I will give you permission to break that law. I do say at the end, there might be consequences, and that's part of this. That's part of the story.
Yeah, yeah. You're not telling someone to steal a car there. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the book, The Things You Have to Do Before I Buy You a Phone, with author Adam Ferguson. So how did it come to your attention that other parents were needing this support in talking about kids and phones?
I think, you know, obviously on the sidelines of playing fields and, you know, just it's a common understood problem. Mm-hmm. You know, I think even Jonathan Haidt had a really powerful book, The Anxious Generation, talking from a data perspective, you know, the anxiety kids are dealing with these days, the depression, the sense of isolation. Mm-hmm. Even the self-harm. I mean, all these statistics have picked up and you can kind of like demarcate it specifically to that period of 2010 to 2015 when phones really started to disseminate mm-hmm. throughout society. And I think that, you know, I'm trying to give us some grace as a culture because this is new and we're experiencing growing pains. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. But I think, you know, you're starting to see schools regulate things, which is great. Mm-hmm. I think there's probably more regulations down the road that will protect kids from, you know, the unseen consequences of what we didn't expect with this technology.
Now, spoiler alert, I'm going to give away the last chapter because your final answer is age 14. Mm. You say that a kid has to turn 14 before they get a phone. But there's some nuance to it. Can you explain that nuance that you have in the chapter?
Yes. Task number 50 is turn 14. And I think that's eighth grade. You know, I would love to, I say in that write up, you know, I would love for you to be kept from spending a lot of your time in technology up to that point. But recognizing that, you know, kids all grow up at different ages of maturity and speeds. And every parent's got to make that call on their own. So it's a little bit of a dad joke, but it's also... it's a good guide point, I think, for a lot of parents to think about waiting until eighth grade.
You have three kids yourself. Did they all pass the test, the 50?
Yeah. So the idea came to me during my daughter's age. Really kind of blossomed when she's my youngest. So mm-hmm. she's in seventh grade now.
So she's not 14. All right.
No, correct. Yeah. She's a very mature, almost 13. My boys are in high school. They're juniors and seniors. And it's funny, whenever... You know, when they got the list, because I gave it to them post phone, they get, every kid I've given it to, they get very excited to cross things off. Mm. You know, they see it as this.
That's what my daughter did. She was like, oh, I've already done that. I've already done that.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Kids love a challenge.
Yeah.
They love it. So it's a great kind of carrot. The book is a bit of a carrot towards getting something that they want. And they are excited to knock them off.
So is your youngest trying to complete the list then? Or
no, I think she's got them all.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she went through it
except
with me.
For turn 14.
Except for turn 14, right, exactly.
Which she has no control over. Oh.
Well, and she's kind of 40 inside, so.
I get that. I have one of those too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So But talk to me about the phone itself versus the social media apps. Because what if the kid has a phone that they use to call or text their parents for a ride home, but not the social media? Because sometimes I feel there is a line there where like the phone is helpful and useful in this day and age for communication, but maybe it's the social media that's bad.
Social media is a total, we could spend an hour on social media.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think video games too suck up a lot of hours.
Mm-hmm.
And
I wasted a lot of hours on Nintendo in my life, but I enjoyed it. I got good at it.
True,
right?
But it wasn't like with you everywhere, right?
That's
it wasn't
true.
With you at school.
You had
it wasn't
to be at
with
home.
You. Like,
yeah.
And whenever a kid gets uncomfortable, what I see them do is kind of dip into mm-hmm. the technology. And I think facing that discomfort, you know, being alone in the world is a good skill. And you learn through experience how to deal with that. But things like GPS even, you know, I mean, I've seen adults get really dependent on GPS, not knowing how to get from one place to another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are lots of things. The phone's a Swiss Army knife. It's a great tool. But there's lots of things that we should probably be trying to do on our own as well. You know, navigating our neighborhoods, coping with boredom, etc.
What about the idea of delaying social media even longer? Because I have joked with my daughter. My daughter does have a phone, but she does not have any social media apps. And I told her she wasn't getting any until she was 25.
I think that's great guidance.
Yeah, and right. I'm serious about that. I know she's going to start negotiating it, but I told her I wasn't even going to consider negotiations until she's 16. But anyway, I joke about 25, but I feel it.
Yeah. I think one of my, it's funny because I don't have any social media, so I'm doing a terrible job promoting this book. But
hence the LinkedIn post. I got it.
Yeah. I mean, I keep LinkedIn just because of, you know, professional reasons. But yeah, I when I talk to my kids about how they use social today, it's they're not using it as much as older generations to socialize, if you will. I mean, Snapchat seems to be a communication device mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, where are you? How do we connect? Kind of thing. And TikTok is less of a social media device than it is kind of like a way to flip channels every 15 seconds, you know, to see content. So I'm hoping things change there. I'm definitely hoping kids can get out of that judgment zone, mm-hmm. which social seems to really do, judging themselves, judging other people. But I may have rose-colored glasses on that one.
Well, speaking of judgment, since you wrote this book, I'm sure other parents that you know have talked to you about it. And if their kid is under 14 and has a phone, do they like say, oh, let's not talk to Adam today?
Well, you know, I think the book can be used even after they get a phone, like mm-hmm. I did with my boys. It's just a great set of life skills and experiences that, you know, I was just talking to your producer as I walked in and she was like, I don't know how to play chess. And I was like, it's a really cool game.
Oh, that's number two.
It takes an hour or two to learn and
mm-hmm.
it's fun.
Do your kids have any favorite ones in here or ones did they offer you any suggestions, I guess, of what to add or, like whenever you were curating your 50?
No, I did not consult my children on any of this.
Okay.
I went back. A lot of them came from experiences that I had with them. Mm-hmm. So the visit a cemetery one was interesting. My son and I were taking a walk and ended up in a cemetery. And the conversation turned to, you know, life, souls, other people. Where mm-hmm. do we go after all this? And it was a great, you know, it's not a conversation you have every day. But it was powerful and it stayed with me in my memory. I hope it did with him too.
Yeah. One that was interesting that just made me chuckle was the eat vegetarian for 1 week.
Yeah.
That's random.
Yeah. Well, it's a challenge. I mean, yeah. There's a couple of like knowing where your food comes from suggestions. So one mm-hmm. is, you know, catch a fish. Mm-hmm. Another one is grow a vegetable from seed. And that one, eat vegetarian for a week, just challenge yourself, you know, try to get through 1 week without eating, any animal products. See if you can do it. Every once in a while, we'll have, you know, a meatless dinner at my house, and it's great.
Yeah, and some of them are also practical, which is probably helpful. Besides do laundry, you have clean the bathroom. You know, just it's being a part of your household. That's
absolutely
what you're getting at.
Yeah, and cleaning the bathroom was a specific choice because it's kind of gross, and it's important for kids to kind of touch that, you know.
They contribute to it. They should have to help clean it up, right?
That's right.
So what's been the reaction like to your book? What do you hear from people about it?
I just think parents are searching for solutions.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's this is a bite of the apple. It's not the holy grail. But I think I think, you know, a lot of parents have said how, you know, things that they didn't know how to do themselves, such as, you know, maybe they've never grown a vegetable from seed. They got to do that alongside their child and kind of bond with them, you know, and have that experience. So it's an activity. It's a little bit of an activity book, but it comes at a critical time in a kid's life. And my hope is that we can just use it or a practice like it to interrupt that digital handoff.
Can you write part two for an elementary school kid that is the things you have to do before I buy you a watch, a smartwatch?
<'Cause> I've heard the things you have to do before I get you a car, before I send you to college,
You could have a whole series here.
That's right.
But yeah, the younger kids, a lot of them all have watches or all want them because their friends have them. So that might be your next book there.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, we have been talking with Adam Ferguson from Upper Arlington, and he's written a new book called The Things You Have to Do Before I Buy You a Phone. Thanks for being here, Adam.
Thanks, Amy.
And this has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.